From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is out today. I'm Barbara Bogave. On today's Fresh Air, we begin our week-long music series with two kings of the blues. We start with the great guitarist and singer, B.B. King. He grew up a sharecropper's son in Mississippi. And in the 20s, before B.B. King got his first guitar, there was Robert Johnson, known as the king of the Delta blues singers. We'll talk with his biographer, Peter Guralnick. The blues, coming up on today's Fresh Air.
Every day I have the blues.
First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Residents of the Barrier Islands near Wilmington, North Carolina, are returning to their homes, and utility crews are working to repair power lines as Hurricane Dennis moves east-northeast along the Atlantic coast. Lita Hartman reports from Wilmington, North Carolina.
Up to 50,000 households lost electricity as Dennis skirted past North Carolina's Cape Fear region earlier today. Chuck Robbins, an engineer with Carolina Power and Light, was out patrolling power lines in a Wilmington neighborhood close to the water. He says Dennis has caused fewer problems than Bonnie, the storm that hit the city last year.
Not near as many trees are down. The lines are mostly all up. Just a few problems as compared to major ones like we had last time. The cleanup should be considerably shorter.
One reason the damage is relatively light is that Wilmington has weathered three other major storms in the last 3 years, and the weakest buildings and trees are already gone. Now that the threat from Dennis is over, residents say they hope nothing worse will happen for the rest of the hurricane season. For NPR News, I'm Lita Hartman in Wilmington, North Carolina.
A House committee has subpoenaed documents and other evidence from the 1993 assault that ended a 51-day siege of the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas. Chairman Dan Burton said he expects to issue as many as 20 subpoenas as his committee investigates the disclosure that FBI agents fired flammable tear gas canisters at the compound. Many of the subpoenas will go to the Texas Rangers, seeking documents and a videotape that some say shows a military helicopter firing on the religious sect's compound with automatic weapons. The compound burned to the ground, killing sect leader David Koresh and more than 70 of his followers. Firefighters are battling wildfires that have consumed thousands of acres in Southern California. Jeff Berry reports from member station KCLU in Thousand Oaks.
Officials say a fire north of Lake Arrowhead, called the Willow Fire, has destroyed 17,000 acres, one home, and burned 30 other structures. A U.S. Forest Service spokeswoman says residents have been evacuated to a nearby high school. Two firefighters suffered minor injuries battling the blaze in the San Bernardino National Forest. Wildfires have been burning across the state. In Northern California, fires have charred almost 33,000 acres and burned 14 buildings. In Southern California, blazes have consumed over 30,000 acres. Meanwhile, an autopsy is scheduled today on the body of a firefighter who was found in steep terrain near Santa Barbara over the weekend. Officials say so far there is no evidence that 28-year-old Stephen Masto fell or suffered burns. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Berry in Thousand Oaks, California.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials lost 176 points to close at 10,914. This is NPR. Public school teachers in Detroit are rejecting their union's suggestion that they extend their contract talks with the school district. Classes are scheduled to begin tomorrow, but the teachers have said they won't work without a new contract. The teachers have not said they're planning an official strike. The United States praised today's UN-sponsored vote in East Timor. The referendum will decide whether the small territory becomes independent from Indonesia. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
State Department spokesman James Foley called the vote a success, although he said the tragic killing of a UN employee marred an otherwise peaceful day. In the run-up to this vote, anti-independence militia often attacked pro-independence groups. Violence could erupt again as ballots are being counted and when the electorate's decision, for or against independence, is implemented. Foley had pointed words for the government of Indonesia.
We note that in these next phases, vote counting and transition, that Indonesia retains the responsibility for maintaining order.
In particular, Foley said, the Indonesian government should prevent armed militia from resuming their activities. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
Jury selection began today in the Indiana trial of a former hospital nurse accused of killing his patients. Prosecutors suspect that Orville Majors may have killed dozens of patients with lethal injections, but they've only charged him with 7 murders. A lawyer for the state indicated today that much of the prosecution case may be based on circumstantial evidence. Shareholders of Atlantic Richfield have overwhelmingly voted to support the sale of the company to BP Amoco. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Today we kick off a week of blues from our archives. B.B. King is the world's best-known living blues musician and arguably the best living blues guitarist. He's been recording since 1949 and has remained true to his style through countless shifts in the pop music world. His personal story is tied to an important chapter in Southern history as well as music history. He was a sharecropper's son who worked on a Mississippi plantation until he was a young man and made his way to Memphis. Terry spoke with him in 1996, after the publication of his autobiography, Blues All Around Me. We're listening to his 1972 recording, 5 Long Years.
If you ever have been mistreated, then you know just what I'm talking about. If you ever been mistreated, people, oh, you know just what I'm talking about. I tell you, I work 5 long years for a woman. And she had the nerve to put me out. You know I got a job at a steel mill, trucking steel like a slave. 5 long years every Friday, I went straight home. Well, all of my pain. You ever been mistreated, people? Then you know just what I'm talking about. I tell you, I work 5 long years for a woman. And she has the nerve to put me out.
B.B. King, what was your very first guitar like?
My very first guitar was a little red guitar about 2.5 feet long. It had a hole in the center, and it was made by a company called Stella, and it was red.
Did you think that was cool or silly?
No, I thought this was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Uh-huh. A guitar made a sound, you plucked the strings. Man, how much more heaven can you have? That's the way it seemed to me at the time. believe it or not, I still hear the sound of that that sound, if you will, through the guitar that I play today.
You hear the sound of that very first red guitar?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
Now, I love the way you describe developing your style. It sounds like you developed your style by trying and failing to imitate your influences. People like Lonnie Johnson, Blind Lemon Jefferson, your cousin Buckle White, Django Reinhardt, Charlie Christian.
Charlie Christian, yes. I'm still doing that.
But still trying and failing.
Yeah, trying and failing, yes.
Now, you also left Hawaiian guitar. How did you hear Hawaiian guitar, and how did it? Why was it so exciting to you? It was another sound you tried to emulate.
Well, I'd hear it on the radio. I would hear the Hawaiian sound or the country music players play steel and slide guitars, if you will. And I hear that. To me, a steel guitar is one of the sweetest sounds this side of heaven. I still like it. And that was one of the things that I tried to do so much, was to imitate that sound. I could never get it. I still haven't been able to do it. And that was the beginning of the trill on my hand.
Tell me more about the trill on your hand.
Well, it's, how can I tell you? It's sort of like, it's not really pushing and pulling the strings like a lot of guitar players think I do. But it's like kind of just shaking your hand and getting a vibration on the string a little bit. So maybe a mini bit of pushing and pulling, but not from the strength of my hand, it's just from the shaking of it.
Now, also, you play a kind of single-line guitar as opposed to, you know, chords or rhythm guitar. Tell me also about developing that style of single note.
Well, every time I've worked in a band, I was always featured. And they'd hardly let me play in the rhythm section, usually. For some reason, most of the players would always say, B, take the solo, take the lead. And I got in the habit of doing that. So I put more emphasis on the single string than I did the chords. I can play a few chords, but I'm no great chord player. But, for example, if you were singing or playing, I could play chords pretty well behind you with a guideline. The guideline mean if I had a bass player or keyboard player, somebody that's playing the chords, I could play then. I could play behind you very well. But other than that, I'm sad. Anybody hear me play by myself, I've just lost that person. You know, they won't listen to me anymore. That's the end.
So did you feel that your strength lay not in just being a guitar player or in just being a singer, but in doing both together?
I think both together. I started to feel that I, you know, had to be a good entertainer to keep a job, and I'm kind of happy that I developed in my head that I'm never any better than my last concert or my last time I played. So it's like an audition each time. Quite often, it's quite a bit like some say when you're going on stage, you have stage fright. In so many words, you get nervous just before going on stage, and I still have that, but I think it's more like concern. You're concerned about the people. It's like meeting your in-laws for the first time.
When I first got the blues, they brought me over on a ship. Men were standing over me, and a lot more with the whip. And everybody wanna know why I sing the blues. Well, I've been around a long time. I've really paid my dues. I've laid in the ghetto flats, cold and numb. I heard the rats tell the bedbugs to give the roaches some. Everybody wanna know why I'm singing the blues. Yes, I've been. Everybody wanna know. Yes, they wanna know why I'm singing.
B.B. King is my guest, and he has a new autobiography called Blues All Around Me. You're from a family of sharecroppers. What was the work that you had to do?
Well, I was a regular hand when I was about 7. I chopped cotton. I picked cotton. I helped to plant it. I did everything that the grown-ups do, and that's mostly the work what had to do with cotton was the king, if you will, of produce in the Mississippi Delta when I was growing up. Peanuts maybe later, and soybeans later. But cotton still is today one of the main produces that's raised in the Mississippi Delta.
Now, what was the financial arrangement between your family and the plantation owner?
Well, a sharecropper was meant to be exactly what they say, sharecropper. But generally, the boss that owned the plantation did all of the paperwork, if you will. He was the CPA. he did all of that, and he sold the produce that you raised. For example, Jim, you earned, after paying me back the advances I gave you, we made 25 bales of cotton, and the cotton brought maybe $5,000 a bale, and you owed me, say, 25 times that, except maybe $2,000. So here's your $1,800.
You know what I'm wondering? When you were growing up on a plantation, family of sharecroppers, did you vow to yourself early on, I'm getting out of here?
Well, not really. Believe it or not, people lived on the plantation, felt like that this was really home, most of them. And we are being taken care of because the boss of the plantation usually was like your lawyer, your judge, your father, your mom. He was your practically everything. And people lived on the plantation, sort of felt, believe it or not, secure to be there. They needed a few bucks. Usually they could get this from the boss man, and it's taken out at the end of the year. At that time, we didn't have telephones. We didn't have electricity or anything of that sort. Later on, I guess we had electricity maybe a year or so before I left when I was 18 years old. And this was all taken care of through a system that you would pay at the end of the year, which came out of your earnings. So a lot of the people, including myself, the early years, just thought that this was it. You know, this, you raise your families and you get old, die, your families take over, kids and what have you, and it's an ongoing process, if you will. But I somehow later start to feel that there was more for me and a few others. I think it's the same way with young people today. They feel that they're not really happy with the status quo,
right,
if that makes sense.
Right.
B.B. King. We'll hear more of Terry's conversation with him after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring Terry's 1996 interview with B.B. King.
You grew up on a plantation, then left it to go to Memphis, which is where you started really playing music professionally. It's a great story how you left the plantation. You were driving a tractor. This was a problematic tractor that had problems with after ignition. So one day you turned off the tractor, walked out of the tractor, and then the tractor started jumping on its own, rammed into the barn. The exhaust pipe got crushed or, you know, broke off.
Broke off, yes.
And you were afraid of how much money you'd owe the plantation owner.
No, I was afraid that I would be killed.
Oh, even worse.
No. Well, he'd never kill anybody, but he, I don't mean it that way, but scared to death. You know, like if you, your mom cooked a cake and you decided that, you know, you're going to get a piece of it and you drop it, you know, and it spills on the floor. Brand new cake that's made for the family. You would feel that mom is going to surely kill you, so you better get out of there. Well, that's the way I felt that the time that the tractor, when it backfired, you know, and ran out of there. It scared me half to death. So I panicked and left, hitchhiked to Memphis. Going from Indianola to Memphis then was like, oh, to me, like leaving Chicago going to Philly. It was that far. That's the way it seemed at the time. So I was scared to death. I left and stayed for a while and communicated back with my family, and my cousin Booker White said, go on back there and take your medicine. So I finally went back, and Mr. Barrett was a very nice guy, a man that I admired so much. I wished I could be a lot more like him.
You know, the good thing is, too, is that that accident forced you to leave the plantation. Maybe you wouldn't have left if it wasn't
No, no. I had planned to leave.
You did?
Yes, I had planned to leave. I had worked with a group called St. John Gospel Singers, and I thought we were very good. I had asked the guys a couple of years before to leave, you know, let's go. I believe we're ready. And each time the crops would be bad or something like that, and somebody would have an excuse, say, well, we didn't do so well this year, let's try it again next year. And I was about fed up with hearing that. I was about ready to go anyway.
What was Memphis like when you got there? What impressed you the most?
It was like, oh, let's say you lived in Cairo, Illinois, and you moved to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's what Memphis was like. Wow, wow. Great big city. I'd never been in a city that large before.
And did you feel like, hey, this city is mine, or did you feel like, I don't belong here?
No, I felt that it was a place of learning because I was lucky. My cousin Booker White lived there, and I had a chance to meet a lot of people when I came to Memphis. And I would go down on Beale Street and hear all these fine musicians playing, especially on the weekends. Memphis was sort of like, again, Chicago or any of the major metropolitan areas. People was coming through, going east or west. In other words, it was sort of like a meeting place, if you will, a port for people traveling from different places. So I had a chance to meet a lot of great giants in the business, jazz and otherwise. So I felt it was something, or a place rather, that I could learn.
Bluesman Sonny Boy Williamson had a radio show when you got to Memphis, King Biscuit Time. And you went up to him and asked to sing on the program. It seems to me like you must have had the courage to just come in like that.
Well, before I left Indianola, my hometown, Indianola, Mississippi, I used to hear Sonny Boy over in Helena, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
He would come on air each day at 12:15 and for about 15 minutes for the King Biscuit Company. And I felt that I knew him. It's sort of like watching TV or listening to you. A person listen to you and feel that they can trust you and feel that they really know you. You become like a name in the family. So that's the way I felt when I met him. I didn't know him, but it seemed to me I had known him all this time. So when I got to Memphis, he was in West Memphis, which is across the Mississippi River in Arkansas. I went over and I guess I would have been hurt very badly had he not talked with me.
He let you sing on his show?
Yes, he did. I guess he said a guy got this much nerve, and I'm very homely looking.
What'd you sing?
I sang one of Ira Johanna's songs. Ira Johanna, if you're not familiar with him, was a great songwriter and great musician. He made a lot of tunes, one or two that you probably have heard. Anyway, I sang one of his tunes called Blues at Sunrise.
And you got a response?
Very much so. Sonny Boy seemed to like it. And Sonny Boy was a very big guy, you know, and his eyes was not very clear, looked a little red-like, and he was a very big fella, and at that time I weighed about 127, and he stood about, 6 feet or more, and looking down on me, you know, like, hey,
you better sing right. And I said, yes, sir.
Well, you ended up getting your own radio show as well as your own gigs in Memphis. When you were on the radio, one of the things you had to do was sing, well, write and then sing a jingle for Pepticon, which was, what, a kind of cure-all remedy?
Yes. Pepticon was a tonic that was supposed to be good for whatever ails you. And we sold a lot of it. And I think a lot of it had to do, I didn't learn until much later that it was 12% alcohol. So a lot of the older people bought it, especially church people. They bought a lot of it.
The only way to drink and be legit.
Well, I won't say that, but I do know that they bought it, and older people mostly bought it, and someone sent me a bottle about 6 or 7 years ago. I have it at home now, and it was, I think, 12% alcohol.
Would you sing the jingle you wrote?
Well, do you really want me to do this?
Mm-hmm.
You really do. Okay. Pepticon sure is good. Pepticon sure is good. Pepticon sure is good. You can get it anywhere in your neighborhood.
And did that sell a lot of Pepticon?
We sold a lot of it. I used to ride the trucks on the weekend with the salesman, and people would stand in line, sort of like going to a concert or a movie. We sold a lot of it.
B.B. King. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1996. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Better watch yourself, babe. You better watch yourself. You better watch yourself, woman, 'cause I've got my eyes on you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Petopia.com, offering food, advice, toys, treats, and supplies delivered to pets and their people nationwide. On the web at Petopia.com. And from Bantam Books, publishers of Victory in Our Schools by Major General John Stanford, a book outlining his essentials for improving our schools. Available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, one of the most mysterious figures in blues history. We talk with Peter Guralnick about the late, great Robert Johnson. And we continue our interview with B.B. King.
That's been the black man you've been loving. Good friend can get my room. I'm gonna write a letter. Telephone every town I know.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. It's the first day of a week of blues on the show. A little later, we'll hear an interview with biographer Peter Guralnick about the blues guitarist and singer Robert Johnson. Now, let's get back to Terry's interview with B.B. King. She spoke with him in 1996, after the publication of his autobiography, Blues All Around Me. In the book, he describes his journey from Mississippi sharecropper to the world's best-known blues musician.
Now, I want to get to another record recorded in 1952. You were 26. This is a recording of 3 O'Clock Blues. It had been a hit a few years before for Lowell Folsom.
Right.
This was your first number one record on the R&B charts.
Very first.
You're coming into your own here, don't you think, as a stylist?
I'm a very happy guy to know that somebody tells me that I have a hit record. I was very happy to hear that. I think that's music to each performer's ear to hear that they have a top-selling record or CD.
Let's hear it.
Now it is 3 o'clock in the morning. Can't even close my eyes.
That's B.B. King, recorded in 1952. How did that record, your first record, went to number one on the R&B charts, change your life?
Well, it changed my life in many ways. One thing, financially, because I had been making about $60 a week at this radio station, and I would go out and pick cotton, I would drive trucks and tractors, I did everything to try to make ends meet, if you will, because my music wasn't taking care of me. And when I made 3 o'clock Blues, I started then to get guarantees, maybe like $400 or $500 a day when I played out. And that made a big difference, as far as financially speaking, because then I could hire more people to work with me, made life easier. I could get a driver to keep from having to drive all the different places by myself. And my wife and I was able to live better, able to pay the band better. I was able to do many things that I hadn't been able to do prior to that. And, of course, my popularity was much more popular, if you will. And I just started to feel then that I was a real entertainer.
In the 1950s, you toured on a black music circuit, and you weren't crossing over, even into the early 60s, to white audiences the way other African-American performers who were playing more rock and roll had started to do, Chuck Berry, Little Richard. Did you want to cross over? Were you frustrated that you weren't crossing over?
Well... In the beginning, I was really confused about the way the politics ran in music. I always thought if you made a good record, it was a good record. If it was a hit record, it was a hit record. And people, not black, not white, red or yellow, but people would like it. Some people would like it. But I learned quickly after I got into the music business that there are so many categories, and you can get lost. You're like... a little fish in a big pond, and more so if you're a blues singer, blues musician.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not really wanting to be a crossover, actually, but I wanted all people to hear it and like it. I was hoping, rather, they would like it. And people like Ray Charles, people like Chuck Berry, all these guys to me were very talented, and they was very energetic. Lloyd Price and so on, all of them was very energetic when it come to playing music. They didn't play the slow droopy drawers music like I did, so I found that maybe that was my reason, because they had things that I didn't have, other way musically or entertaining.
Well, they were playing to teenage audiences, and as you've always pointed out, your audience...
was always my age and older.
Yeah, yeah, so... Mm-hmm. Could you imagine yourself crossing over to teenagers, playing to teenagers?
No, I could not. And again, I'm trying to say that to hear the people that I mentioned playing,
mm-hmm.
I was never envious of them.
And because me, I'm the country boy that, you know, that left the country, but they never got the country out of me. So I didn't have that, stage presence that they have. So I was never envious of them being able to get over, but I would hope that people sometime would pay more attention to what I was doing.
In the mid-60s, I guess it was, a lot of the rock guitarists started emulating you. I mean, you became a god to some of them. Mike Bloomfield, Eric Clapton. And that helped introduce your music to college audiences. And then you started playing the college circuit in addition to the places you'd already been playing. What was it like for you to start playing the college circuit? Did you feel like did it feel very different to you? Did you feel like you needed to change anything about your performance style? Was there anything you were doing that didn't seem to translate?
Yes, I was frightened at first. Here I am, a high school dropout, and I'm going to be playing to college audiences. Yes, I felt that I should wear a hard hat and be Fred Astaire or Nat Cole.
Be real suave.
Yeah. But I remember after 3 o'clock blues, I had a manager, and he told me when I was going, it used to be a saying that for a black performer, it was four theaters you had to play and be accepted before you would be accepted as a true entertainer. One of those theaters was the Howard Theater in Washington, the Royal Theater in Baltimore, and the master itself was the Apollo Theater in New York, in Harlem. So my manager told me then, I lived in Memphis, he said, don't go to New York and these other places. Oh, and by the way, the fourth theater was the Regal Theater here in Chicago. However, my manager said, do not go to New York trying to be Nat Cole or anybody else that's trying to be slick, because there are people that sweep in the floors that are much better than you'll ever be. So the best thing for you to do is go there and be B.B. King.
What good advice.
Sing 3 o'clock blues. Mm-hmm. Sing the song that you sing the way you sing them. He said, now, all these other people can do all of those other things, but they can't be you as you can be you. And that I've tried to keep from then until now.
It's been said that you've always felt bad that you dropped out of school, never went to college. Were you self-conscious about that when you were actually playing colleges?
Yes, very much so. I thought that my shortcoming as far as the education was concerned would make me not be, shall we say, good enough to play for a lot of those people.
But it was probably just the opposite, that your audience really wanted to be you.
Well, I don't know about that, but they did show me that they appreciated me being there. They mm-hmm. still do that. They showed me that they was really with me and supported me in what I was doing. So they gave me confidence.
I have met over the years a lot of people who've worked with you or toured with you. And it's just not possible, I think, to get anybody to say a bad word about you. I mean, your reputation is of somebody who treats everybody around him really well, with a lot of respect, always fair. Financially and in all other ways as well. And I'm just wondering if that's something that you consciously set out to do. I'm not just trying to be nice here. I mean, I think it's just a kind of a fact that you're known for this. I wonder if you think of yourself just naturally Mr. Nice Guy, or if it's something that you've felt really obliged to do and have been very conscious about doing.
There are some things that I've read that I truly believe in. I believe that one should treat others as they want to be treated. And that's one of the things that I try to live by, if you will, is trying to be fair to people as I want them to be to me.
One of your recordings that I particularly love happens to be a recording with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Your recording of Don't Get Around Much Anymore.
Right.
I mean, gee, you don't even play guitar on this. It's so strange. It's such a unusual recording. My fantasy is that someday you'll record an album of jazz standards.
You must be reading my mind.
Really? Well, go ahead and do it.
Yes, I'm hoping to do that someday with standard tunes like Don't Get Around Much Anymore and tunes of that kind. You know what else? I would also want to do an instrumental album doing tunes like the Beatles did and other known tunes like that of today. I would like to do both.
I had a feel of singing with the Ellington Orchestra. And,
frightening.
And not have a guitar. I mean, I don't think
well,
you're
I was afraid to try to sing and trying to play guitar would have been just too much. But today I'm more familiar with a lot of the standard tunes, and I would like to try and play the melodies instead of singing them.
B.B. King, it's really been such a delight to talk with you. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you. You're very kind to talk with. I enjoy your voice.
Missed the Saturday dance. I heard they crowded the floor. It's awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore. I thought I'd visit the club. Got as far as the door. I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore. Darling, I guess my mind is more at ease, but nevertheless, why stir up memories? Been invited on dates, I might have gone, but what for? I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore.
That's B.B. King and the Duke Ellington Orchestra, recorded in 1961. B.B. King spoke with Terry Gross in 1996. His autobiography, Blues All Around Me, is available in paperback. Next up, writer Peter Guralnick on the tragic and brief life of blues musician Robert Johnson. This is Fresh Air. Peter Guralnick writes that when he was a freshman in college, his most precious possessions were his blues records and the portable stereo phonograph his mother purchased with green stamps. Guralnick never outgrew his love of the blues. He went on to write books and articles about blues, country, soul music, and rock and roll. Terry spoke with Peter Guralnick in 1989. He had just finished his book, Searching for Robert Johnson. It was based in part on research done by Houston folklorist Mac McCormick for a book that has remained unwritten. Johnson is one of the most mysterious and revered figures in blues history. He was poisoned by a lover's jealous husband and died in 1938 at the age of 27. Even if you don't know his own recordings, you might know the versions of his songs recorded by others, such as the Rolling Stones' Love in Vain and Eric Clapton's version of Crossroads. Here's Robert Johnson's 1937 recording of Hellhound on My Trail.
I got to keep moving, I got
Christmas Eve, and tomorrow was Christmas Eve. If today was Christmas Eve, and tomorrow was Christmas Day, oh, wouldn't we have a time, baby? Oh, I wouldn't need my little sweet ride just to pass the time away, to pass the time away.
Guralnik calls Hellhound on My Trail Johnson's crowning achievement. Terry asked him why.
Well, I think in a lot of ways it's not just Robert Johnson's crowning achievement, but almost the pinnacle of the blues. It focuses a degree of intensity and a degree of lyrical power with an almost frightening kind of, paranoia is the wrong word, but I mean it's just a sense of being pursued, a sense of, it's very explicit in the lyrics, but I think what's most extraordinary about it, you couldn't just recite the lyrics, is that the music echoes the lyrical content so precisely and so almost frighteningly that, to my mind anyway, it's something which is both a pinnacle and it's also something which is very difficult to listen to. It's definitely not casual listening.
Do you remember when you first started listening to Robert Johnson's records and what that experience was like and which were the first records or what was the first record that really drew you in?
Well, I remember it vividly because the first album, King of the Delta Blues Singers, came out when I was a freshman at Columbia in 1962. And I can just remember listening to that album over and over and over again. I mean, it was a thrill almost beyond my imagining at this point because it was in such a void. There wasn't anything like it, and there weren't a lot of blues records out at that time. And the thing that was so extraordinary about it was that it wasn't just any blues record, but it represented a whole world, almost a worldview and a poetic vision that I had never picked up before. As much as I loved the blues, and that I don't think I've ever seen replicated since.
It's hard to make out the words even now, and I'm sure it's remastered better now than it was when you first started listening to Robert Johnson. I'm just wondering if that added to the mystery of it and added to your appreciation of it, the sense that it was somehow within reach but out of touch, who he was and what he was singing.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think that looking back on it, I don't think there's any question that my friends and I created a romance, I mean, out of Robert Johnson. And to some extent, perhaps that violated the reality of the person and of the artist. We certainly... We argued over lyrics. We would listen and listen, and things that then seemed the subject of such intense debate seem so obvious now. It's almost laughable, but that was part of the attraction—the remoteness of it, and the remoteness from our lives, and the sense of this is not something I'm particularly proud of, or that I think is anything to be enthralled about. But I think it's this. This you create this sense of someone living on the edge out of a person who lives a life entirely different from your own, and ultimately you may find out that you're living as much on the edge as anybody else. But it, you know, you're. I think that you're always looking for that kind of that kind of intensity, I guess.
Yeah, well, you're talking about intensity and living on the edge. I mean, here's a singer who sounds tormented in some of the songs. And some of the songs are about the devil or about having a hellhound on his trail. Were there what kind of impressions have you gotten about Johnson the man as far as, like, how emotionally stable he was? Was he emotionally disturbed when he was recording and when he was singing? When he was alive is, I guess, what I'm trying to say here.
See, I guess I would take a more prosaic view of it now. I mean, I would see Johnson, in a sense, as a conscious artist, as someone who was seeking to create a specific effect. And the odd thing is that the more you learn about the person, Mac McCormick described him as a cipher, in a sense, in the views. He gave back exactly what the person he was with wanted to see or find. In my interviews over the years with people like Johnny Shines and Robert Jr. Lockwood, who were probably as close to him as anybody, there isn't a strong sense of personality. there's a sense of someone who perhaps was brooding, but who created his music out of an internal strife, say, but certainly it was not evidenced from their descriptions in his external life. And he was a very resourceful guy. He was a person who went out on the streets, and he might play the latest Bing Crosby tune or Tumbling Tumbleweeds. He had this memory, this he could hear a song once and recreate it note for note, according to Johnny Shines. So, I mean, there was a great deal of technique and a great deal of facility involved. But what made Robert Johnson Robert Johnson was, I think, that it was, in a sense, the same dedication that you'll find in the work of any conscious artist, of, you know, of a Duke Ellington in a more sophisticated form of music, or a great writer. And that's the sort of thing that comes across to me, which in some ways I suppose is equally romantic, but it's a different kind of romance.
Peter Guralnick from a 1989 interview. We'll hear more of Terry's conversation with him after the break. This is Fresh Air.
And I followed her to the station with a suitcase in my hand. Well, it's hard to tell. And all your love's in vain, all your love's in vain. And the train pulled up to the station. I looked her in the eye when the train rolled up to the station.
We're back with writer Peter Guralnick. His 1989 biography is called Searching for Robert Johnson.
A lot of people like to imagine what it would be like if Robert Johnson had lived, what kind of music he would be playing today. And as you point out in your book, some people say, oh, he would have been a brilliant innovator. But you think not necessarily. You've seen it happen both ways, that someone survives and remains brilliant, and other people even forget their own songs over time.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that struck me about Robert Johnson is that he was... he seems to me almost a kind of incandescent spirit. I mean, the brilliance of his achievement and the intensity of his music was such that it's hard to imagine it being extended, you know, for too long. In a poetic sense, which is not to say in a real sense, but in a poetic sense, I mean, it almost seems fitting that is certainly to the legend that's been created around Robert Johnson that he should have come to an end in the way that he did, because it's almost as if there was nowhere else for him to go in his music at that point.
You know, I think you have an experience, and you've managed to express it, that a lot of other people have experienced too, and I think it's a very interesting one. I'm thinking of you as a white teenager in a suburb of Boston, hearing music from black rural musicians that was recorded decades earlier, and somehow this music speaking to you with an intensity that no other music ever did before. I don't know, I just find that really interesting to think about in terms of people living very different lives than you do, speaking more directly to your heart.
Well, it's a very peculiar thing, and one that something that I think back on often. The thing that's even odder about it, though, is that it's not something that was confined to the experience of someone like me growing up in a suburban, you know, home in the Northeast in the 50s. And I mean, in talking to people like, I was asking Eric Clapton, I interviewed him fairly recently, mm-hmm. and his experience was almost identical, you know, in an entirely different world. And he was talking about how Keith Richards, whom he didn't know at that time, had exactly the same experience with Robert Johnson. So that it's There's something both external and internal. I mean, I think there's no question that the exoticness of the music must have been, and perhaps of the experience, must have been something that really appealed to me as a kid and appealed to probably Eric Clapton, Keith Richards, and, you know, a whole generation of people, or part of a generation of people anyway. But there was also something in the music, something intrinsic, that could cut across these barriers of class and background.
Peter Guralnick spoke with Terry Gross in 1989. The second volume of his two-part biography of Elvis has just been published. It's called Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Kathy Wolf, with Monique Nazareth, Alan Tu, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publishers of Legacy, a biography of Moses and Walter Annenberg by Christopher Ogden, in hardcover wherever books are sold. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our Blues Week with two rock performers who were influenced by the great blues artists who came before them, Eric Clapton and Bonnie Raitt. Join us for the next Fresh Air.